Hello and welcome to the Health and Happiness Show on Untangled FM. I'm Edwina Griffin. Last week I spoke to happiness expert Dr. Timothy Sharp, and he mentioned exercise as a key factor in ensuring happiness. Do you ever find that you want to exercise but you just don't have access to a gym? One of the easiest forms of exercise to do anywhere, anytime is running. The thing I love about running is you can do it almost anywhere, anytime, and sometimes it can be one of the most beautiful locations on earth, running through mountains, along the coast, through the forest. People take up running at all different stages of life. Fun runs, half marathons, marathons are a great goal to achieve as well. And today on the show, I'm excited to have an expert in this area. He has a PhD in exercise physiology from Indiana University, a master's degree in kinesiology from University of Calgary, bachelor's degree in exercise and sports science from Pennsylvania State University. He's taught at several universities and currently teaches applied exercise physiology at Miramar College in San Diego and dissertation writing at University of California, San Diego. He's an internationally recognized running and fitness coach, freelance writer and physiologist. He owns runcoachjason.com, a state-of-the-art science running coaching and personal training company in San Diego. As America's running expert, he won the 2011 IDEA Personal Trainer of the Year and is a sought-after speaker on running and fitness. He's a regular presenter at national coaching and fitness industry conferences, including US Track and Field Cross Country Coaches Association, American College of Sports Medicine, IDEA World Fitness Convention, SCW Fitness Mania, ECA World Fitness Convention, and Fitness Fest, among others. I can go on and on. He's taught USA Track and Field's highest level coaching certification and was an instructor at the USATE-US Olympic Committee's Emerging Elite Coaches Camp. He regularly holds coaches for runners, coaches and fitness professionals, and is a prolific writer with over 200 articles published. He also has written 4 books, including Running for Women, 101 Winning Race Strategies for Runners, and 101 Developmental Concepts and Workouts for Cross-Country Runners. That will almost cover it, I think. That's part of it anyway. I'd like to welcome Dr. Jason Karp to the Health and Happiness Show. Welcome, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wow, there's a lot there. I'm quite excited to be chatting to you. I'm training for an event myself, so very excited to have you here. Now, a lot of people sort of ask me, a lot of my clients ask me about running, and is running a sport everyone can do, or are some people just not predisposed to running? Can you hear me?
There seems to be a bit of a delay.
Did you hear the question? I was just asking in terms of can everyone run, or are there bodies that are predisposed and not to running?
Most people can run. Some have things that can prevent them from running. Like one of the things is being very overweight. It's hard for very overweight people to run initially. A lot of people have to lose weight before they start running. But as I tell people, running is something that's very natural to humans. We all evolved to run. So it's much more natural activity than swimming or cycling. So, yeah, most people can run as long as they are not extremely overweight or have other kinds of orthopedic problems that would prevent them from running.
Mhm. Mhm. And so when did your passion for running begin? Jason, can you tell us a bit about your story and how you came to be an expert in this area?
Oh, Edwina, it all started from a race around the track in sixth grade. Ever since I ran my first track meet in sixth grade, I've been very enamored with the sport of track and field, and not only the physical benefits that it gives you, but also the emotional benefits and the challenge that it presents. It's very unlike any other sport. In that, it can be very physically demanding, but in that, it's also a learning experience. You learn a lot about yourself and what you're willing to do to meet a goal and how hard you can push your body. And so it's been a very big part of my life ever since sixth grade.
Yeah, and so you often speak about, well, you've referred to with me before, the inner runner. And is that what you're speaking about? Is that in terms of that parallel to life strategies and goal setting for business in all areas of life, or is that a different psychology that you speak about when you say the inner runner?
Oh yeah, it's all about looking inward and looking at the non-technical sides of running and how it allows us to become better people and how it allows us to challenge ourselves in a way that is unique from most other situations in life. So, yeah, I use that term, the inner runner, as a way to look inward and discover who we are through running.
And what about also, you know, when you're speaking about psychology, the runner's high that people speak about, could you explain a bit about that and what exactly happens
right,
when people are running
to,
in the runner's high? And...
Yeah, that has to do with chemicals in the brain that are there to make us feel good, like dopamine and serotonin, and things are activated during intense exercise. And so that's where this whole issue of the runner's high has come about, because people often sense that when they run, it releases these chemicals in the brain that make us feel good.
Yeah, yeah. And is that for all levels of intensity of running?
No, usually it's in response more to higher levels of intensity. It doesn't happen as much with lower levels of intensity. It happens, it's much more common with moderate to high intensity exercise.
Okay, so in your, is it Revo 2, your running team that you operate?
Revolt Running
Is
Team,
that
yeah. That's
name?
Yeah.
Revolt.
It's actually an acronym.
Okay, Revolt.
The three main physiological determinants of distance running performance: running economy is the RE, the VO2 is short for VO2 max, and the LT is short for lactate threshold. So those are the three main.
Can you explain a bit more about those?
Right, VO2 is the most common one. Everyone's heard of VO2 max, the maximum volume of oxygen that the muscles can consume per minute. And so that represents your aerobic ceiling. And then running economy is how much oxygen you consume at any sub-maximum speed of running. So if you ran at some easy pace, you're going to consume a certain amount of oxygen to maintain that pace. And the lower amount of oxygen that you consume to maintain a given pace, the better your economy. And then the final one, lactate threshold, represents the fraction of the VO2 max that you can sustain. So lactate threshold is like the fastest sustainable aerobic pace. So you take those three components together. Those three components together will influence how fast somebody runs any given race, from the mile up to the marathon.
And with the lactic threshold, so kind of hitting the wall that you often see at the end of races with, you know, whether it be marathon races or 400 meters or whatever, can you explain that a bit? Because I know some, quite a few of my clients that don't really understand or didn't understand what that is and why that happens in layman's terms, if possible.
Sure. I mean, the lactate threshold, technically it is the speed above which lactate accumulates in the muscles. But lactate's not a bad thing. There's other things that happen at the same time lactate accumulates that causes fatigue. And one of those things is that the pH of the muscles drops. And so you have this acidic environment inside the muscles. And that influences metabolism and the rate at which we can produce energy to contract our muscles. So you can think of the lactate threshold as the fastest speed that you can maintain before you start to develop this acidic situation in the muscles. So it's not an easy jog so fast either that you're going to fatigue quickly. It's the fastest speed that you can maintain aerobically. So it feels comfortably hard.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So it's more the acid that inhibits the ability of the muscles to produce energy, the body to reduce energy.
Right. Yeah. If we were to exercise above the lactate threshold, then fatigue will happen much sooner because of all the, quote, anaerobic things that happen inside the muscles.
Okay. So now when people are starting a running program, what are some of the common mistakes you see when people embark on a new running program if they haven't done much running before?
Well, there's a few things that, you know, people tend to be very aggressive right out of the gate. And so they go from doing nothing to, you know, joining a marathon training program where they're being asked to run very long distances very quickly and they haven't ever done that before. So the biggest mistake that people make is that they just try to do too much too soon, and that's the biggest reason why people get injured. are just trying to bite off more than they can chew. You know, they should try to become a runner first and get used to running before they try to do something like undertake a marathon.
So when you say become a runner first, I mean, you know, isn't it, as you sort of said, it was a natural movement pattern to run. Do people actually need coaching on how to run to be doing it the correct way? Or, you know, when you say learn how to run, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, a lot of people, there is a skill to it like any other skill. However, the skill is minor compared to the skill of other sports like tennis or volleyball. They have a much bigger skill component than running does, because we have all evolved to run, and we all know from the time we're kids how to run. Having said that, however, there are specific things that people can focus on to become more efficient runners. You know, a lot of people get injured because they're not running efficiently, and their legs are not able to absorb the shock the way they need to absorb the shock in order to prevent themselves from getting injured. So there are technical things that they do to work on running technique and form. But the biggest factor in terms of becoming a runner first is learning how to live the lifestyle of a runner and getting used to the pounding of the pavement on a fairly regular basis, whether that's every day or every other day. You know, most people, if they have gone 40 years of their life without running and now all of a sudden they start to run, running is very stressful on the skeleton, and so you need to take your time and adapt to it before you try to do some kind of long event like a marathon or something else.
Yeah. And when you speak about sort of, you know, the shock on the body and the stress on the body, what's your opinion on running shoes? You know, I'm kind of confused now. It's like when I grew up, it was the Dunlop Wellies, and they were pretty basic. And then it's sort of more, you know, very supportive running shoes. Now we're seeing these, like the flat shoes again, and then there's the MBTs and barefoot running. And what do you think about these choices, and does it differ between distances of events, or?
Yeah, it's all crazy, Edwina. A lot of crazy stuff going on right now in the running shoe business. And it's a long-winded answer. Long-winded answer, but the short answer is that for most people, they need the protection of running shoes. People have been running for many years who, you know, are used to the pounding and have the joint structures able to handle all that stress, they can start to integrate using what's called these minimalist shoes. But for most people who start a running program, they really need the protection that shoes give them. And so it's not really a good idea for someone who's 40 years old who's never really run before to start wearing these minimalist shoes or the barefoot running, because they really do need the protection and learn how to handle the impact before they go and add more stress by running without shoes. A lot of this minimalist footwear has come out of looking at what some of the best runners in the world do, but some of the best runners in the world grow up in countries that are very poor where they don't wear shoes. So if you're running without shoes from the time you're a kid, then yeah, by the time you're an adult, your feet and all the supporting structures have adapted to not wearing shoes. So that's a completely different story. But most people in developed countries don't go barefoot their whole lives. So if you're going to put a minimalist pair of shoes on somebody who's been wearing shoes for 30 or 40 years, then that's an injury waiting to happen.
Yeah, interesting, because several of my friends of being of stress fractures as a result. I did wonder. So the research, you know, around that is kind of based on, as you're saying, more elite athletes.
Yeah, there's really no research yet that's examined whether or not these shoes make somebody a better runner or reduce the risk of injuries. And so it's going to take some time for really to see whether or not these minimalist shoes really have the impact that they're claiming to have. Right now, a lot of it is based on anecdotal evidence and looking at, you know, this from an evolutionary perspective and how, you know, in ancient times, people never wore shoes, so they think it's a more natural way to run. But you could also make the argument that sleeping in a comfy mattress on a bed is not natural, so maybe we should all just sleep on hard floors.
Yeah. Well, they also didn't have concrete in ancient times, so the surface was probably a little more giving than the hard concrete we run on now.
Exactly.
Or the track. Okay, no, thanks. That's great to clear that up from my point of view as well. I know several people are confused at the moment with all these shoes. And what's your opinion on the different surfaces that you can run on, like in terms of running on concrete, running on grass, running in sand, running through the water, in terms of the benefits or, you know, possible risks of each? Do you have an opinion on that?
Some of it depends on if you're preparing for a race, then what surface are you going to run? You want to run on the surface that the race is going to be on. Like, for example, mm-hmm. if you're going to run a marathon that's going to take place on the road, you do all your long training runs on the road because you got to get your legs used to the pounding on the road. But the research actually doesn't support that running on softer surfaces reduces the risk of injury. And that's another thing that people think, well, I'll run on grass and I have less chance of getting injured. Well, that may or may not be the case. So I think it's good to run on a variety of surfaces just to get a variety of training, but running on harder surfaces isn't any worse for you than running on softer surfaces.
Mhm. Mhm. As long as you've got good shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
What about how important do you see interval training or like in terms of training for endurance events? Is that still as important for an endurance event?
Oh, yeah, interval training is extremely important, but only after a good amount of aerobic mileage has been done. So a lot of people misuse interval training because it is the fastest way to get fit. But if you do the interval training after you've spent a lot of time running easy, you'll get more out of the interval training when it's time to do it. But interval training gives you the potential to focus on very specific aspects of your fitness to improve your fitness level and get faster. So the shorter the race that you're training for, the more important interval training becomes.
Mhm. Yeah. So in, say, a longer distance event, I guess it would come in for more the sprint phases or the hills or whatever in that event. Would that be right?
Exactly. So like for a 5K or even 1,500 meters on the track, there's a lot of interval training done to train for the 1,500 meters.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's also been some research I saw on your website, actually, about running twice a day for an event versus once a day when training for a long-distance event. Can you explain some of that research and the pros and cons on those?
For most people, they would benefit most from running once a day. But once the runs start to take longer than an hour to complete, then there's some benefit at least two or three times a week to break it up into two runs a day. For one thing, if you break up your runs into two runs a day, you can get more kilometers in that day with less stress. And that's really what training you're trying to do, is get the most out of the training with the least amount of stress. And so to do, you know, a 9-kilometer run and a 6-kilometer run is less stressful than to do one 15-kilometer run. So it's a great way to increase the total volume of work that you're doing with less stress. But there's one run during the week that should always be done all at the same time, and that's the long run, especially if you're training for a long-distance event like a marathon, because there are some specific physiological characteristics inherent in that long run that you need to get out of. So the long run should never be broken up into two runs, but other runs during the week could definitely be broken up into two runs to minimize the stress on the body.
Interesting. And what do you recommend using heart rate monitors for monitoring and charting results?
Yeah, I think heart rate can be a very valuable tool, especially during such things like interval training. Like if you're doing a VO2 max workout, the goal of that workout is to reach your maximum heart rate during the work periods and then have the heart rate drop during the recovery intervals. So with a heart rate monitor, you can see how close you're getting to your maximum heart rate, and you can adjust the pace based on the heart rate information.
Right. Okay, so. And do you use it throughout the program, or it's pretty well just in the interval sessions?
Yeah, they can also be used on easy days to make sure that you're not running too fast. That's another big mistake that a lot of runners make, is that they'll run too fast on their easy days. So again, they're adding more stress without any extra benefit. So having a heart rate monitor can give you that instant feedback to know whether or not your heart rate's too high and then you need to slow down. So it could prevent you from running too hard on the days that are supposed to be easy.
Yeah, great. Yeah, that's a really cool one. Because I often find it's the easy days I'm supposed to be cruising that I feel good, and I'm like, you've got to control yourself sometimes.
Right.
And you also refer to mitochondrial biogenesis. Can you explain to us what that is?
Yeah, that's a very fancy term, but one of the more elegant adaptations to endurance training is that you increase how many mitochondria you have in your muscles. And the mitochondria is where aerobic metabolism takes place. So if you want to run faster over a given distance, or you want to be able to run a longer distance, a lot of that comes down to how much mitochondria you have in your muscles. So the more mitochondria you have, then the greater the capacity for the muscles to consume and use oxygen. And so biogenesis just means the creation or formation of these new mitochondria, which is very sensitive to the volume of aerobic work done. So when people go out and they run every day, one of the great things that will happen inside their muscles is that they make more mitochondria. The mitochondria that they already have get larger so that their muscles can consume and use more oxygen, and then they can run a 5K or a 10K or a marathon faster.
Okay. So speaking of oxygen uptake, what's your opinion on high-altitude training?
I have lots of opinions on high-altitude training.
Oh, really?
I think it is way over-exaggerated. And again, just like the shoes, this is one of the issues that people look at what the best runners in the world do, and they think that just because they're doing it, everybody else needs to do it. And so because the Kenyans and Ethiopians live and train at high altitude, everybody thinks, oh, that must be why they're so good, and so we have to do it. But that's not really the case. And so one big benefit of training at high altitude is that you make more red blood cells. You make more red blood cells, and you have a greater capacity to transport oxygen in the blood. So that's a good thing. But training at a high altitude also means that all your workouts are going to be slower because there's less oxygen available. So you have more red blood cells on one hand, which is a positive adaptation, but you're running slower all the time on the other hand, which is a negative adaptation. And so the question becomes is which one is going to exert the greater influence on your performance? And so if you're going to use high altitude training, you really only want to be there for a matter of a few weeks, just enough to make more red blood cells, but not long enough that the slower speeds are going to negatively influence your performance. So the best way to really use altitude training is if you can live at a high altitude, but train at as close to sea level as you can.
So come down from the mountain each day to train.
That's, it's not very practical. There are only a few athletes in the world who can really, you know, enjoy the benefit of doing that, because there aren't too many places in the world where you can have altitude and sea level within an hour's drive from one another.
Yeah, but that's interesting. That's yeah, thanks. That clears that up, because I'd heard the mixed opinions on that, so that explains the options for it. And what about recovery in terms of a running program? How important is that?
Recovery is very important, because that's where all the adaptations are made. So you don't, all these mitochondria we're just talking about and all the other adaptations, you don't make those things while you're running. It all happens when you're not running. So recovery is extremely important, because it allows you to make the adaptations that will eventually allow you to run faster. So everything you do when you're not running, like nutrition and sleep and hydration, and all the other physical activities you're doing the rest of the day, all those things need to be addressed if you're interested in really improving your performance and becoming the best runner you can be.
And what's your opinion on sporting drinks and hydration during events?
Hydration is extremely important for long races, not so much for a 5K or a 10K. because those races aren't long enough to get you dehydrated. But half marathons, marathons, mm-hmm. ultra marathons, hydration is one of the things that limits performance. So being able to consume fluids during the event is extremely important to try to delay when you become dehydrated. Because when you become dehydrated, mm-hmm. that influences your ability to transport oxygen because blood volume decreases.
Right. And I just had a question that's gone. So, and what about actual supplement gels, like the gels and things to take during? We're talking more endurance events now, obviously. Are there any that aren't, that you would recommend against, or is there any advice that you would give on that front, and how often they should be taken? I'd heard most recently it was kind of every 15 minutes or something through an event.
And for longer races, that becomes important, because any race that's longer than about 2 hours, you're going to run out of your muscle store of carbohydrates. And so you need to replace that carbohydrate so that you can hopefully maintain the pace. Because once you run out of the carbohydrate, muscles are forced to rely on fat, and then the pace is going to slow down because you get energy from fat a lot slower than from carbohydrate. The muscles would rather use carbohydrate if they can. So any one of these gels or something that's easily digestible that allows glucose to enter your blood as quickly as possible is going to allow you to maintain the pace in these very long endurance events. So there's not one specific product that's better than another, and some of it comes down to the person's gastrointestinal system can tolerate. But the goal is to try to delay the drop in blood glucose for as long as you can delay it. So to take some of these gels and very easily digestible forms of carbohydrate and get it into you during the race so that you maintain blood glucose levels for as long as possible.
Great. Now, I see you've written a book on running for women. What are some of the considerations? Obviously not all, because people can buy your book, but just in terms of some considerations women need to have regarding their menstrual cycle and training regimes, and in terms of the difference between men and women with doing a running program.
Right. Well, women are very, very interesting human beings, Edwina. And there's a
are, on many levels.
There's a lot of things that women have that men don't have to ever consider. And so women have things like their menstrual cycle and the influence of hormones. They have pregnancy, menopause. A lot of women have anemia, which is the loss of iron in the blood, because if you bleed a lot every month with your menstrual cycle, then that's going to affect performance, because hemoglobin, which carries oxygen in the blood, is made up of iron. So women who lose a lot of iron every month, they're going to negatively affect their ability to transport oxygen in the blood. So there's lots of things that women have to address that men don't, and that influences how they should train. One example is that women are very good at utilizing fat for energy and conserving the limited store of carbohydrate that they have. So women are very good at very long endurance activities. And if you look at race performances between men and women, the longer the race, the closer women get to the men, because men go right to using their carbohydrate and they run out sooner than women do. So women are predisposed to endurance kinds of activities because of their muscles' ability to use fat for long periods of time.
Interesting. And what about in terms of structuring, our program around the menstrual cycle, and should that be considered when writing the programs?
Right. So it turns out that estrogen has a lot of different effects on things like metabolism and exercise performance. And so women, if they really want to maximize what they're getting out of their exercise program, then they should address times of the month when estrogen is high. And estrogen is high a couple of times during the month. In the middle of the follicular phase, which would be about days 6, 7, 8, 9 of the menstrual cycle. And then in the middle of the luteal phase, which is days 22, 23, 24 of the menstrual cycle, those times of the month when estrogen is high are times when women can really push the envelope and get more out of their workouts. Estrogen seems to be an exercise-friendly drug. And so women can usually work harder and work longer at those two times of the month when estrogen is high.
Wow, interesting. Okay. And then you know, obviously allowing recovery around those peak times.
Yeah, because it turns out that estrogen also influences the muscle's ability to recover. And so women can seem to recover faster than men can because of the influence that estrogen exerts on muscle and the repair of the muscle damage that comes with training.
Wow, that's interesting. I never heard that before. I knew that. Yeah. So no excuses then. yeah, okay, so it helps with recovery. That's amazing.
And so times that women do not have estrogen, like in the cases of menopause, or if a lot of women who have very low percentages of body fat, they'll start to lose their menstrual cycle. And so in those kinds of conditions, when estrogen is no longer present, then that also has ramifications. One is on bone health, because estrogen has a huge protective effect on bones. So if women lose the protective effect of estrogen, then their bones are at risk for fractures. And so then women need to try to do other things to prevent a fracture.
That's interesting as well, because I know when I was competing when I was younger a lot, my menstrual cycle was almost non-existent. So then you're kind of countering that benefit then. It's like crossing it out, negating the positive.
Exactly.
Because many athletes don't have a proper period due to their excessive training loads.
Yeah, it's very common among, especially endurance athletes.
And then, into menopause, then you've got that whole bone density issue associated with it. Although running, I guess, is helping with bone density in itself.
Yeah, any weight-bearing exercise. It is very good to increase bone density. Another reason why running is better than other kinds of cardiovascular exercises, because of the effect on bone.
Yeah. And what about some of the research on running for weight loss and the effect of, also the effect, I saw something about the effect on weight loss once someone stops running, having been a runner.
Running is the most effective strategy for weight loss because of how many calories it burns. And so there's a lot of research to show that the more people cut back on how much they run, then the more their weight starts creeping up because running is so effective for weight loss. So if you want to lose weight and you're physically able to run, running is going to be the best choice of activity for you, because it involves most of the muscles of the body, and because every time you land, you're placing 2 to 3 times your body weight on each leg, it's a huge calorie burner.
But then there was something about, is that once you stop running, then you can tend to put on a lot more. Is that just because of the eating patterns established when you're running? More than anything physiological?
Yeah, it's both the eating and the fact that you're taking away the physical activity component. So even if you don't change your diet and say you've been running every day and then you stop running, and even if your diet doesn't change, now you're going to start putting on weight because you've lost that calorie burner every day.
Yeah.
Because running is more effective for burning calories and losing weight, it really is the best strategy not only to take the weight off, to maintain your new weight once it's off.
Yeah, right. Okay. And when someone is on a running program, what are some of the tips? I mean, you've mentioned in terms of reducing chance of injury, you've mentioned the need for recovery. What other factors do you see as being, you know, hugely important to help reduce that chance of getting an injury.
Well, the biggest one is being smart about how you train and not doing too much too soon. And that's the biggest reason why people get injured, because they're just trying to increase the stress of training at too quick of a pace that their bodies are not able to handle at that time. So being very systematic and careful about how you increase your training from week to week or month to month, that's going to have the biggest impact on not getting injured, and how the components of training are all put together. Like not trying to increase the training volume at the same time you're increasing the training intensity. If you're increasing the intensity by doing interval training, then you either want to maintain the volume you've been doing or even drop the volume back a little bit. And most people will try to still increase the volume while they're trying to do the interval training. So how you put the training program together, that's what's going to have the greatest impact on whether or not you get injured. And apart from that, then you have the issues of recovery and doing what you need to do to recover, sleep and hydration and nutrition, and then making sure you have the proper running shoes for your foot type and running mechanics, and then making sure that, like I said again, you don't increase the training load too much. And if you've already been injured, that predisposes you for another injury, because that shows that that body part is vulnerable. So even more care has to be taken. You know, maybe you need to add some strength training to address a strength imbalance that you have. So that's something that also needs to be addressed, some strength imbalance that's there.
Yeah. So, yeah, do you see weight training as being an important element for all programs? I mean, is that for everyone, or I guess, you know, are there specific weight programs you usually recommend with your programming that, I mean, not to outline them, but is there a sort of generic program that most people should be following, or is it very, very individual based on physiology, different physiology?
It is individual, and it depends on whether or not a person needs it at all. You know, like if someone's training, with my own clients, if they're training for something as long as a marathon, well, then the bulk, if not all of their time, is going to be spent on the running, because you just simply need to do a lot of running if you're going to train for a marathon. And people only have so much time and energy, you know, physical energy and mental energy to devote to training. You have to ask yourself, well, where's the time best? Is it better spent going from running 40 kilometers a week to 50 kilometers a week, or is it better spent staying at 40 kilometers a week and going into the weight room? And that answer might be different for each person. For most people, the answer is running more is going to be more beneficial. But if you have and that needs to be addressed, then that person needs to do some kind of specific strength training to address that weakness. So it does depend on the person. It depends on the length of the event that you're training for. The shorter the race, then the more important strength and power becomes, and then the more important strength training becomes.
Yeah, yeah. And what about, you know, the need for, if you are training for, you know, assuming endurance events here, so half marathons, marathons, the importance of, say, massage or acupuncture or that sort of therapy, is that an essential component, in your opinion, for recovery and injury prevention, or not necessarily?
Well, again, that depends on the person. I mean, there's lots of recovery modalities, but... it depends, because you know, the average person who isn't doing all that much running and may run, you know, 2-3 days a week, you know, they probably don't need to do all those other things. But somebody who's running, you know, 150 kilometers a week, then they need to really address all the other components of their life, and they have to make sure that they're, you know, optimally recovering, because they're trying to handle a very large training load. So it all depends on much training the person's doing and what the person's goals are, how far they're trying to get with all of this. And so the average person doesn't necessarily need to go get a massage every week unless they really want to, because it feels good.
And what about sleep patterns? I mean, has there been much research on the amount of sleep needed? Because I know often, you know, one of the issues with people is they're trying to keep a job and they're trying to train for an event and fitting it all in and then trying to fit in sleep.
Well, sleep is very important because it does impact recovery. And most people do need at least 8 hours of sleep a night.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the argument could be made that if the choice is between training more and sleeping more, you'd have to sleep a little more because that's where the adaptations to training occur. So you won't get
mm-hmm.
anything out
okay.
of the training if you're not recovering properly, and sleep is a big part of recovery. And
yeah.
There's plenty of research
that
shows.
Yeah.
There's plenty of research.
Because a lot of people sort of let you say your research. Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
I was just going to say that there's plenty of research to show that just a couple of nights of losing sleep already negatively affects performance. So sleep is extremely
yeah.
important in order to perform at your best.
Yeah, okay. So, and as people get fitter, you know, I've often heard people say, well, I'm so fit, I only need 5 hours sleep a night. And that is not necessarily reflecting the research, I would assume, after what you just said.
Yeah, most people think they can function on a little bit of sleep, but their performance really is going to be hurt by it, even though they may not
mm-hmm.
realize it or feel it. Their performance will be hurt by losing sleep.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing that comes up with a lot of people running is cramping when they're running in long-distance events. Do you have any tips for that strategies, or explanations, I guess, for the reasons for cramping and how that can be avoided?
Yeah, well, it depends on the exact thing that's affecting or influencing the cramp, but usually the cramp comes just from, you know, a lot of people think it's due to dehydration, but it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be more a property of the muscle itself and premature fatigue in the muscle. So
mm-hmm.
training actually is one thing that can, you know, alleviate or prevent cramps. A lot of people get cramps
mm-hmm.
like toward the end of a marathon, their calves start cramping up, but just going on more long runs and getting used to that and training your muscles to delay fatigue. That is one big
right.
thing that can prevent cramping. So a lot of people cramp.
Okay, so it's highly linked to fatigue, is it?
Yeah, at least the muscle cramping is. The other
mm-hmm.
kind of cramping, you know, the stomach cramping or the gastrointestinal cramping, that's probably due to the movement of internal organs as you run. And so that's a different issue than the specific muscle cramping. The muscle cramping is mostly a fatigue issue, whereas the other cramping may be due to a couple of things, the movement of the internal organs, you know, and also like a lot of people may, if you went to go run within 20 minutes of eating and you have all this fluid and food in your stomach, that could be an issue. There's a couple of different issues there, but that's separate from the training issue. It's separate from the muscle issue.
Okay. I wasn't aware of the gastrointestinal cramps, so that's interesting too. And how can that, if it is gastrointestinal cramp, you're saying movement of the internal organs, I mean, what can be done? They can't do a lot about that, surely.
Yeah, that's a little bit trickier one to get rid of, but... And sometimes changing body position can help with that, and massaging and pressing on that area, drawing blood flow to that area can help with that. But those are the common side stitches that people often get. But it seems to be related to body position, and sometimes if people bend over a little bit or press, massage that area with their fingers, that sometimes can help alleviate that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And not eating 10 minutes before you go run.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any other tips for what not to do on a race day?
Well, there's a lot of things not to do. One is not to go out too fast.
Right.
That's probably the most common error that people make when they race is that they don't learn from their training, and so they have this inflated idea of what they're really capable of doing. And so they'll run the first kilometer or two at a pace that is over their head, and then they slow down during subsequent stages of the race.
Uh-huh.
The best strategy somebody is interested in running as fast as they can on a given day, the best strategy is to start out at the pace that you can honestly maintain the whole time.
Yeah, it's easy to get caught up in a race when everyone, I always find there's always people spreading out the front and you suddenly think, wow, I'm not going to be able to keep this up at a whole distance.
When the sun goes off and everybody just bolts to the front, that's what everybody wants to do, and it's easy to just get pulled out with everybody else. But it takes some maturity to let that happen, and it takes knowledge of your fitness level and some restraint, knowing that if you are patient in the beginning and run smart in the beginning, it's going to come back to pay off huge dividends in the later parts of the race.
Yeah, yeah. So like the tortoise and the hare, pretty well. Not necessarily quite as slow as a tortoise, though.
Yep.
So do you have any other winning race strategies for us?
Oh, there's a lot of those.
Yeah, just a couple. To keep us, give everyone a taste of your books.
One is how people warm up before a race. You know, most people should warm up and finish their warm-up running at the pace that they're going to run in the race. So the warm-up should be very progressive, starting slow and then getting a little bit quicker and a little bit quicker until the pace matches the pace that you're going to run in the race, so that you rev the engine and then it's a smooth transition from the warm-up into the race.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't do that. They'll go from like a slow warm-up and then try to run fast in the race, or they'll run too fast at the end of the warm-up and then the race starts and they've already put themselves in a fast mode, so they start out too fast.
Mm-hmm.
The warm-up should be done in such a way that it makes a smooth transition from the warm-up into the race.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Another good strategy is learning to how to use your emotions. You know, like we were talking about earlier, that running is a really good chance for you to discover things about yourself. And so in a race, that gives you an opportunity to discover those things. And if people can learn how to look within themselves and put their emotions on the line, then that will serve them very well and allow them to win, to run a winning race. But not to be afraid to put your emotions out there and, you know, think about a very emotional time of your life, whether it's having lost a loved one or something else that brings emotions to the forefront, and use those emotions to drive you to the finish line.
Okay, so using that as, yeah, as a driver versus, because, you know, in some, there's kind of that thing with sports where you're trying to, you know, focus on the event and focus on your time and focus on your pace and focus on your breath and da da da. So you're kind of saying to bring the emotion forward as a motivator in terms of, if I run, you know, this much faster than that type of motivation, or, you know, a driver in the subconscious of, okay, you know, I'm doing this for this or for that.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both. Using the emotion. It is subconscious, as we all know. You know, when we become emotional, there's a subconscious ramification to that. But using the emotions to really pull something out of you that normally you wouldn't able to be pulled out of. And so there's a deeper sense of being able to deal with the discomfort, using your emotions to deal with that discomfort that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many times, it's very similar to how people often find that in challenging times of their life, they're able to do something that they didn't think that they could do. You hear that all the time from people. When they lose a parent or they lose a child, they go through some major tragedy in their lives, don't know where they find the strength to be able to cope with that and move forward. And the race is very similar. That there's times in the race when it's going to be very difficult, where it's very, very physically demanding. And so those are times where we draw on these deeper emotions and find a strength that we didn't know we had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, yeah, like you say, then that empowers us for other areas of our lives once we've, it's kind of that
right.
tick list, I've done that, now I can do anything kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I like that. So do you have, you know, any running events for you, and what sort of, how do you keep yourself motivated with your running? Do you find events work, or is it a natural thing that you love every day without having an event, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a part
running?
Of, yeah, it's such a part of who I am at this
yeah.
point that the motivation is not a problem, but I still do like to mm-hmm. race. I'm still training to race, but I don't necessarily need a race in order to motivate me. You know, I still run every day, and I still do the workouts just because I've been doing it for so long, and it's an integral part of who I am at this point. So I don't even question it anymore. It's just like brushing your teeth. You got to brush your teeth every day, and I have to run every day. It's, you know, I'm not me if I don't run.
Yeah, yeah, and you motivate many people doing it. So do you have any other, any running events this year? No. You, what about your camps that you operate and events that you have on?
Yeah, well, I happen to live in a part of the U.S. There's lots of running events, so there's no races to do around here. So, you know, mm-hmm. I'm always running 5Ks and even in some track meets when I get the opportunity. I love running on the track. It's a great chance to run fast, and I love the chance to run fast. But with the people that I work with, you know, they're getting ready for a variety of events, half marathons, marathons. I coach people around the United States, and depending on where they live, there may be a marathon that they're training for or a half marathon. So there's all different kinds of events. There's not just one. There's all different distances that I'm training people for.
Yeah, and you have programs, like, do you have tips for periodizing programs on, you know, for long distance? I mean, I know you offer online programs, I think. That's correct?
I have training programs that are on my website for a variety of distances from 5K to the marathon, and those are downloadable mm-hmm. on the website. So anybody training for an event can just go to the website and download a 20-week training program for all different levels, beginner, intermediate, advanced levels of runners.
Yeah. So that's at the runcoachjason.com, yeah?
Correct.
Yeah. So when people are periodizing for a long-distance event, you know, what's the lead time difference? If you say someone's doing a 5K or a 10K or a half marathon or a marathon, how long do they need to allow for that training program to be structured and periodized correctly?
Well, that totally depends on a number of things. Number one, how good they want to perform. You know, if their goal is to just finish a marathon, then they don't need to train nearly as long as if their goal is to run the marathon the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
So one is
mm-hmm.
what their goals are and how good they want to be. The other thing is what level of training they're at. So a beginner may need to spend more time to train for a certain event than somebody who's already been running for 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. So what about someone who, you know, a typical, I'll just go from a typical client that I know of, which would be, you know, typically running around 5K, and they're wanting to do a half marathon and then, or then a marathon. Just in terms of people having an understanding of when they should be signing up for programs and, you know, how much planning they do need to be allowing. What would be, yeah, sort of, you know, and someone like that who, the sort of lead time?
For your average beginner runner, for a 5K, most people could accomplish a 5K within a couple of months. So within 8 weeks, that should be
yeah.
enough time for most people to be able to run a 5K. For a marathon, mm-hmm. it really does depend, but I would say at least 8 to 10 months. If you're going from really being a beginner, you know, and you're trying to get yourself to run 42 kilometers, you really need many, many months to prepare for it. So even though there's a lot of these marathon mm-hmm. training groups that are 5 to 6 months long, a lot of people are getting injured because 5 to 6 months of running 3 or 4 days a week is not really enough time to prepare for a marathon and do it safely. Most
mm-hmm.
people need 8 to 10 months. Some might need even a whole year to get their bodies used to pounding the pavement.
But
I would suggest that people start with the shorter races, and this all goes back to what we were saying earlier about becoming a runner first. Get used to the shorter races, run a bunch of 5Ks and 10Ks, and then naturally progress to the half marathon and the marathon.
And that's great. So they can basically find, you've got programs for all of those distances, don't you, on your site, which is runcoachjason.com?
Yes, I do. For beginner, intermediate, advanced runners, for 5K all the way up to the marathon. There's actually 16 programs on the website. They're all 20 weeks long. That can be manipulated. The number of weeks can be manipulated within each program if you need more or less time.
Fantastic. And then can people work with you one-on-one as well?
Yeah, so I have people that I coach in person as well as through email around the country. And so that works very well. And I enjoy the more personal coaching the best, and I enjoy that the most of everything I do.
Fantastic. And so are there any other tips you want to leave us with? I mean, you've given us a huge amount of information today.
Well, I think that a lot of people are intimidated by running when there's really no reason to be intimidated by it. It's just a matter of not doing too much too soon and being very systematic about how you run every day and how you train. And if you do that, then everybody can enjoy running instead of being intimidated by it and instead of being injured by it. There's way too many injuries and there's no reason for it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you certainly outlined some of the key things that people do need to know and the risks and the benefits and everything today. I think people will have a really good start point to then. And if you also offer programs, so there's no excuses now. Everyone should be out there doing it.
I mean, both in terms of preparing for events as well as for burning calories and losing weight, running really is the best form of cardiovascular exercise.
Yeah, and like you say, we're born to run anyway. It's a natural movement pattern for us all. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jason Karp, for joining us on the Health and Happiness Show today. Some fantastic information, and if you wanted to contact Jason, you just go to runcoachjason.com. Next week on the show, I'll be speaking to one of Australia's pioneers and world experts on wellness and wellness programs in Australia and internationally. Thanks for joining us, and we'll speak to you next week.